Second Aliyah of B'Shalach. Those of you just joining us, our Mahalach for Chumash in general is that we try to do one Aliyah a year, one Aliyah every week. So this year we're working on Sheni. So our task for today is to look at Sheni of Parshas B'Shalach, and it's a relatively short Aliyah. It's only about five or six psukim long, but there is quite a lot in it. There is a lot to say about these few psukim. So let's try to look together a little bit at what we find in this Aliyah. So what's going on now is, as we know, this is Shabbos Shira. This is the Parsha where the Jews end up declaring their gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by Kriyas Yamsuf, because Kriyas Yamsuf happens in the Parsha. And as the Parsha begins, and as we discussed last year from Rishon, so the Jews are being chased now. The Mitzrayim have come after them. And the Aliyah begins, Vayirdufu Mitzrayim achareihem, V'yasigu osam chonim al yam, kol sos rechav paro farasha v'chelo, al pi achiros ofnei bal tzafon. So the Mitzrayim have chased after them, and they have, so to speak, chapped them. And the next pasuk goes on to say, Ufaro hikriv. And that language is interesting. You would think it should really say Ufaro karav. And Medrash has a comment in the Bali Atosus quote that he was Makari of the Jews, so to speak. It wasn't his goal in life, but he essentially made the Jews frumer, that he inspired them to turn to God with this sudden pressure, which is an interesting thing to ponder in general, what exactly was going on. Some point we'll come back to in a minute. So the Jews were concerned. Vayisu v'nei Yisrael esenehem v'hinei Mitzrayim nosei achareihem. Vayiru'u ma'or v'yitzaku v'nei Yisrael el Hashem. So they saw that Mitzrayim was chasing after them, and they got very scared. So Mitzrayim is singular. They saw Egypt chasing after them. So what does that mean? How do you understand that? No, Mitzrayim, no say Achareim in the singular language. So if you look at Rashi, it's a little bit jarring. You may get a little bit of a shock, because what does Rashi say about that singular language? B'lev echad k'ish echad. It's familiar. Right, where does that sound like? Sounds like the Jews at Har Sinai. So that's a little hurtful, because we're so proud of that, the whole song, right? The whole song about it. We declare the great pride in the achdus of the Jewish people. And here we find essentially the same thing being said about our pursuers, about the Mitzrayim. So on the surface, one way to look at that is that it simply emphasizes the fact that achdus is a very powerful force for good or for bad. Whatever it's being harnessed for, it's significant. So it's significant when it's the Kabbalah Satorah, and it's significant when it is chasing after the Jewish people. As the Gemara says, Kinas Tzadikim Tov La'olam, Kinas Rishayim Ra La'olam, that it's good whether you're the superhero group or you're the League of Supervillains. They're both powerful when they band together. But it's actually interesting, there is a difference between the two. And if you notice, it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't necessarily notice, but said the phrase is familiar, it's not identical. It's actually switched around. So Rashi, by Maimon Har Sinai, says, Ki ish echad, b'lev echad, and here it's backwards. B'lev echad, ki ish echad. So is that a significant difference? Is that just a stylistic point? Is there any significance to what comes first? So Rav Huttner thought there was. Rav Huttner in the Pachet Yitzchak on Pesach has an essay. It's Maimer Mem Aleph in the Pachet Yitzchak on Pesach. So Rav Huttner suggests that the difference is significant, that when we talk about the Achdus of Klal Yisrael, what we mean is that it's as if the different people in Klal Yisrael are different parts of the same body. So it's like Reuven and Shimon are the right hand and the left hand of one body. And therefore, the fact that they do the same thing, it makes sense because they're all expressing the will of one unity. While Rishayim, when they get together, it's not because there is any inherent achdus. It's because they have a common plan, so therefore they decide to make an alliance. This is an important distinction between an alliance and general unity, and it comes up a lot, that anyone's capable of forming a team effort, for all kinds of purposes. But that's not the same thing as genuinely feeling a connection to someone else and genuinely feeling an identification. So that's like, for example, I'm sure you've heard the vort in Parshas Korach. So the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, that's the model for a good machlokas, machlokas l'shem shamayim. And what's the example of a bad machlokas, machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim? That is Korach v'Hadassah. And so many mefarshim on Pirkei Avos, ki'ish echad b'lev echad, they all say the same vort, that there's a lack of symmetry. Right? If you're saying Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, you should say Korach and Moshe. What's Korach v'Hadassah? So many mefarshim say the same idea, that Korach and his men, they were also not really on the same side. They all had a common enemy, so they all banded together to fight Moshe, but each one was really looking out for himself. So even within each other, they have divisions and they have machlokas. So that's the nature of an alliance, which can be for bad purposes. It's very different than genuine achdus. So that's what Rav Huttner says over here, that the Jews in Maamar Har Sinai, they are ki'ish echad, they're all genuinely united. So therefore, they act b'lev echad, therefore they act to all do the same thing. But by Rishayim, it's only if they are b'lev echad, if they all have a common goal, they all have a common purpose, so then they act b'lev echad, then they act ki'ish echad, they all act the unified function, they all get together to pursue their goals. So the next pasuk is a very famous and very challenging pasuk. So the Jews who are scared here, so they said, "Vayomru el Moshe hamibli ein kvarim b'Mitzrayim." What's the problem here? There weren't enough graves in Egypt. Lekachtanu lamus b'midbar. So you took us out that we should die in the desert. Mazos asisolanu hotzionu b'Mitzrayim. Why did you bother taking us out of Mitzrayim? It doesn't seem to be worthwhile, we're going to die out here in the Midbar. So this is difficult to understand, partially because we have kind of a mixed picture of the Jews at this point. So the Dor HaMidbar on one level is presented as a very exalted generation. And as the Ramban says, whoever they are, it's very hard to believe that somebody who's in the middle of being rescued in such a dramatic way is going to so quickly sour on the whole thing and challenge his Redeemer in such a blatant fashion. And especially, we just said a minute ago, Paro Hikriv, that he inspired them to do tshuva, they were in the process of getting closer to God. So what's pshat on this type of rebellion? The Gemara in the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says this was one of the times, Asara Nisyonos, you know, God tested Avram 10 times, and the Jews tested God, so to speak, 10 times. What does tested mean? So it seems to be, as the Mefarshim point out, it's like a parent says to a child who's misbehaving, you're testing me. Right? Not meaning that it's an actual test, but meaning that they're pushing the limits of the patience. It's a way of saying you're angering me. So the Jews angered God on a number of occasions. On 10 occasions, this is one of them. When they were so chutzpahdik, in the middle of their salvation, to say, Hamibli ein kvarim b'Mitzrayim. Very hard to understand just by itself, but it's hard to understand if we believe that they were on such a high madrega. So the Ramban has a couple of approaches to this. The Ramban asks this question. And the Ramban has a few answers. One answer, as he says, is that this was not everyone. That there were different groups among the Jews. There were better Jews and there were worse Jews. So there were some Jews who were inspired to tshuva, and there were some Jews who were the complainers, who were able to see the negative side in everything. And all they could think about was Hamibli and Kvarim b'Mitzrayim. He notes, others note that the Targum Yohanan, that he adds in the words over here, Rishay Dara, the Rishayim of the generation. This isn't emblematic of what everyone in the group was saying, but there were those who had this attitude. You know, this ability to be cynical and to find the bad in everything. This is presumably also pshat in Parsha Shmos, when Moshe Rabbeinu kills the Mitzri, and then he comes back, and he comes back to Mitzrayim, and he tries to stop Dathan and Aviram from fighting with each other, and they say to him, "Oh, you're going to kill us like you killed the Mitzri?" And Moshe says, "Achein no da hadavar," which on a pashtus level means, "Oh, I see that it's known what I did." But Chazal understand that it means something else, that not that What I did is known, but now I understand why the Jews are in Galus. Why? Because they speak Lashon Hara. Because why are they talking about my killing the Mitzri? Clearly they are people who engage in such gossip, and therefore it's understandable that they're in this kind of suffering. So from a straight-out Hilchos Lashon Hara perspective, it's a little hard to understand if somebody killed somebody. So presumably that's relevant information, and presumably that's considered to be litoelas. So presumably what we mean over there, when we talk about Lashon Hara, and we translate Lashon Hara in general as saying bad things that are true, as opposed to Motzi Shemra. So what we mean is that really Lashon Hara and Motzi Shemra, they're both false. They're just differently false. That Motzi Shemra is you make up completely false facts. You fabricate things out of nowhere. And Lashon Hara, you take facts and you portray them in a very unfair light so that it creates a negative impression. So the Jews, of their state of Galus, and the Dasanans and Avirams of them, when we talk about them being engaged in Lashon Hara, it's not simply the fact that they reported that Moshe killed someone, but that Moshe was trying to protect the Jews in doing things like that. Moshe was saving a Jew who was being hit. And to spin that as, okay, so now you're going to kill us too? You're going to kill Dustin and Aviram? That's the kind of person you are? You're scum, somebody who likes going around killing people? So that perspective is a tremendous chutzpah, a tremendous negativity that's imposed upon the facts. So too, there were Jews who were expressing the sentiment now also, but perhaps that's not reflective. Perhaps that's just a small portion of the population. The Ramban has a few other answers also. He also suggests that this was maybe said earlier, and maybe now they actually have come more towards tshuva and more to appreciate what is really going on. But this is a citation from earlier. A third interpretation he has, which is also interesting, is that perhaps, yes, they did do tshuva, and they did feel close to God, but they were suspicious of Moshe Rabbeinu. They didn't trust Moshe. So they said, okay, God is doing us miracles, and maybe Moshe has brought us out here that we should die in the Midbar. So maybe that's pshat. Simcha Zisselbroi, the Chevron Rosh Yeshiva, in his Sefer Som Derech, he has a whole essay about this in the back of the Sefer, in the Mamar. Whole essay just on this one line in the Ramban. And his basic take is that it says, first of all, you have to understand that the generation was made up of tremendous tzaddikim and an unbelievable milah. And therefore, he says, when there's any criticism that's addressed to them, it's the kind of criticism that you find, like when Moshe Rabbeinu was criticized for an avera, that for us wouldn't even be an avera, but just when you're on a very high level, so God is much more medakdek on you. So too, that was going on. They were very holy, but they had certain failings. They didn't properly appreciate on a perfected level what exactly was going on. And he connects this, if you remember, I think we spoke about this year, Parshas Chayisara, that it's brought down that the Nisayon of burying Sarah was one of the greatest Nisayonas. And it's hard to understand why that was such a powerful Nisayon. And we mentioned at the time, I think, the explanation that what Avram was being tested with then was all the obstacles he had in burying Sarah. It's a possibility that he's not going to be able to properly be makir tov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the chasadim that he's had, because he's weighed down by all of the issues that are presenting themselves. So too, the Jews at that time had a similar nisayon, that they're being rescued, they're being pulled out of slavery. But at the same time, okay, so there are certain impediments. Will they be able to see that with emunah, or will they get knocked off course by that? So to that standard, they did fall somewhat short. And he suggests a more charitable reading. He says, they thought that, okay, so we had a certain amount of zchus that got us this far, but now our zchus has run out. And now apparently HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan is that we're going to die. And just the question is, so then why is it that we're dying in the Midbar? Why didn't he kill us in Mitzrayim? It must be there's some extra madrega of punishment we need, that we're being brought out to the wilderness for it to happen here. But that maybe it was a legitimate question, and maybe essentially the saying, so okay, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decided to execute us, why didn't he do it there? Why are we being brought out to the Midbar? Is it for a lack of graves? Is it there's some other toelis? What exactly is the nature of our failing that that's that that has to happen. So he sees it as more of a spiritual striving, less of a complaint, but more of a cheshbon hanefesh that they're going through and trying to understand what to do with it. Hi.
Why do we assume they're righteous? I mean, intuitively, they're slaves, and the Medrash says that they were immersed in Mem Tet Shari Tumah, so...
Right.
Happened.
Correct. So part of it is that since then, though, there is this act of tshuva, for example, the Medrash is finding in this week's, in this, the Pasuk in this Aliyah, about Paro Hikrib. I mean, that's a minor reference, but the assumption is that through this experience, they are elevated tremendously, and that's what the Gemara says in the Masechta Sanhedrin, that by the time they reach Yamsuf, that the level of Nevuah, the Gemara has the expression that Mashara Shifcha Layam, Lara Yechezkel, Matarasa Shifcha Layam, Lara Yechezkel Ben Buzi Ben Nevuaso, that they were on a level of prophecy. The smallest among them was on a level of prophecy that was greater than that of Yechezkel Hanavi. That there are many references in Chazal that they had reached a very high spiritual level by that point. And if you're interested in the topic in general, I would recommend reading this essay. It's actually a 15-page essay or so in the back of the Sefer Sam Derech, where he develops that theme at great length, and that's essentially the gist of it, that he wants to highlight, first of all, that any criticism of the Jews at this point is of the kind that you find when great tzaddikim are criticized for falling short of a higher standard the rest of us wouldn't even take notice of, and that that's the nature. This was more of a cheshbon hanefesh than it was a complaint. But it's still considered one of the nisyonos. It's still something that they're taking the task for, but in the Moshe Rabbeinu sense, you know, in the sense that somebody who's on a very high madrega is held accountable for things that we wouldn't even notice.
The Mishnah highlights.
Sorry.
There's an opinion in Chelik that says that the
Darmikor. In the Chelik Mahavah, right? So there are conflicting messages in Chazal about how to interpret that, and that's also part of what he's saying. That perhaps, again, the criticism is just on a whole different level than we can really relate to, but on coming from a starting point, they are tremendous tzaddikim, and they had reached a very advanced level of spirituality by that point. So there's a lot to discuss about this pasuk. I have probably mentioned in the past that it's especially relevant as we approach Adar and Purim, or now it's now together Shloshim Yom, right? We're within 30 days almost, another day or two. We're within 30 days to Purim. So today is today, Yudal. So we're together Shloshim Yom. So Rav Hirsch has a very important comment. Rav Shamshon Ufal Hirsch, I think we've mentioned in the past, that this comment on the Bli and Kvarim B'Mitzrayim, so Rav Hirsch explained that this is not a genuine question in his interpretation. He didn't really think that there was lack of cemetery space in Mitzrayim, but that this is essentially a sarcastic comment. And he goes on to comment that this was a coping mechanism. You often hear people say in sociological studies and the like that it's inescapable that there is a very high percentage of Jews in the comedy business. Clear that there are many, many Jews who are engaged in the business of making people laugh and who are associated with a sense of humor. So there's been a lot written about this, about why is it that Jews are so associated with a sense of humor, both personally and professionally. And it's often been suggested that it's a reaction to persecution, that if you're going to survive centuries of the world trying to kill you, so you need to develop a sense of humor in order to cope with it. So most of the sociologists who make this point, they don't cite Rav Shamshon Ufal Hirsch, who says exactly that in this commentary to Chumash. It says that the Jews were essentially coping through cracking jokes. They were making sarcastic comments, and that was how they were able to endure this great terror. And then he says, and that's what Jews have done ever since, that this has been the policy of the Jewish people, one of their strongest tools that they're able to cope through their sense of humor. So this is a topic, again, maybe as we get closer to Purim, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more. I don't remember whether I've discussed it in the context of this year or not, but I've definitely discussed it here in Yeshiva in the past, that there's a lot to discuss about the role of a humor in Judaism, the role of having a sense of humor, of being able to laugh, and what jokes can accomplish. And I think on the most basic level, so this is step one, that the ability to help you cope through the day, that you should be able to survive all the challenges of life, and you can preserve your mental health because you're able to crack a joke. So that's a tremendous toelus. That's something that's clearly of fantastic value. And any discussion about what does having a sense of humor accomplish in a Torah Hashkafa, I think can start from there. And then that point, once you acknowledge that that's true, so then it's not a very big leap to say that it's the chesed to provide this for someone else. That if you have someone else in your presence who is going through suffering, who's having a hard time, if you're able to make them laugh, so you're going to accomplish clearly a tremendous chesed. Happens to be the Rambam writes this in his medical writings. Rambam wrote not just on philosophy and halacha, but also on medicine. So in his medical writings, he writes that when you visit somebody who's sick, so part of what you want to do is to try to make him laugh in order to really affect something positive towards the situation. The Reader's Digest did not make up the idea of laughter is the best medicine. But the notion that it's a chesed in general to be able to provide this for people is pretty explicit in a Gemara Maseches Tainis. And the Gemara towards the end of Maseches Tainis tells the story of Rav Broka Chozov, who was in the marketplace, and he saw Eliyahu HaNavi. So he asks Eliyahu HaNavi for some inside information. He says, here in this whole marketplace, who in this arena is zocha to a special reward in the next world? Who are the B'nai Alma Da'asi in this area? So Eliyahu HaNavi said, is that guy, and there's those two guys over there, and that guy, and then he disappears. So Rav Broka had to figure out what was so special about these people. So he asked all the people, what do you do? What is your job in life? And when he got to those two people in the corner, he said, what do you guys do? So they responded, Anshe Beduche Anan, Kam Bedachina Natsivi, that we are jesters. We are people who make jokes, and we have a sense of humor. And when we see people who are depressed, so we make them laugh, and we cheer them up through our sense of humor. They also said that when we see people fighting, so we get them to calm down and to get along better. That's what we do. So apparently the Gemara is telling us that this attitude and this kind of behavior is worthy of a special chelik and olam haba, and that's what made these people b'nei alma da'asi. So that's when you're providing it for someone else. And here you find from this pasuk, the way Rav Hirsch explained it, that just for your own sake, to be able to laugh at things, to be able to crack a joke, has a very important psychological protection involved. It enables you to survive the tremendous pressures and persecutions that life sometimes brings. And this is particularly a Jewish attribute. So this is an idea that many secular scientists later commented on as well, but they should give proper credit to Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, who says it in his commentary, and they can read it in English because it's printed in English as well. Hi.
This might be a very broad question. I don't know if everyone wants to answer now, but in regards to Rav Hirsch's saying, and I've seen it many times in like similar veins, if you have the Rishonim and the Rejushim pointing in like one direction with a certain pair, so what's the license, I guess, of an Acharon to have a much more original sort of interpretation of it?
Seeing in terms of what this pasuk, whether it is
right,
a complaint, whether. So that is a very broad question that we'll have to probably take up a different time. But we see already, even before him, that there's a couple of different ways to look at it. And you know, either Ramban already raised the issue that it's just not clear how to interpret this in light of other attitudes that we see in Chazal. So I think there are other cases where it's more blatant and it's worthy of discussion in general anyway. But I don't know if this is the most jarring example where you have a very solid approach from the Rishonim that's really agreed upon and then later generations.
It's not solid in the first place.
I think there are places where that question presents itself more strongly and it's definitely a worthy topic. Probably won't be able to devote time to it today. But in this case, I think it's already seen in the Rishonim that there is what to try to figure out. The Chazal have placed this in the context of something that was angering God, but we see from the Ramban's question that we have to figure out how that makes sense in terms of other things that we see in Chazal and how all of it comes together. So I think there already is the ground prepared for different interpretations about what is the thrust of this comment. Okay. So, a lot to say about just those few words. I mean, B'li'in K'varim B'Mitzrayim, there's a lot to ask. So then the next pasuk continues. Halozeh davar asher dibarnu alecha b'mitzrayim lemor chadal menu v'avdas mitzrayim ki tovana avdas mitzrayim v'sein b'midbar. We were better off there. We at least we weren't dying in the desert. So Moshe responds, just to skip to these last two psukim here. He says, Vayomer Moshe la'am al tiro, shouldn't be afraid, his yatzavu uru'us Yeshua Hashem. Right, this is a pasuk, this is a song also, right? And yatzavu uru'us, so you should stand still, and you should see how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saving you. Asher yasa lachem hayom, ki asher yisem es mitzrayim hayom, lo so sifu l'rosu mod al olam. Hashem yilachem lachem v'yatem tacharishim. So don't be afraid, you should stand firm, and you should watch how God is going to save you. And you can be quiet, you're not going to see these people anymore, and God will fight for you when you can be quiet. So what exactly is going on here with all of these different things that he's saying? So the Yerushalmi in Maseches Tainis has a comment that there were different groups, like we said before, not all the Jews were on the same page. So there were four different groups at that time. He says there were those who said, just give up, we're gonna just, let's just jump into the ocean, let's just kill ourselves, let's just forget about it. There were those who said, let's turn back to Mitzrayim, let's give this up and go back to work. There were those who said, we can take them on, let's fight them. And then there were those who said, let's scream, which apparently means let's scream to God. Well, let's scream to God in a very audible way that'll have an impact on the Mitzrayim. But there were those four camps. So to that, Yerushalmi tells us that Moshe was addressing all four of them with what he says here. So those who say, we give up, let's just jump in the ocean and end it. He says, Al tiro, siyatsvu, ruas, yeshua, sashem. Don't be afraid. Recognize that God's going to save you and watch. To those who said, let's go back to Mitzrayim, he said, no, that's not happening. You're not going to see these Mitzrayim anymore. You're not going back there. And those who said that let's take on the Mitzrayim and fight with them, he responds, Hashem yilachem lachem, God's going to fight on your behalf. And to those who said, let's scream and let's try to accomplish something that way, he says, v'atem tacharishin, you'll be quiet. So there's a lot to comment about some of those ideas specifically. And we'll come back to it in a second, but this pasuk loso siful erosa mod olam, which is in the middle there, there's a lot to say about that by itself. So you will not see them anymore. It sounds like, and Rashi sounds like this also, it sounds like that's a havtacha, that God is saying, don't worry, these people who you're so scared of, who are chasing you, you won't have to see them anymore. But it sounds like from Chazal, this is also something the Ramban emphasizes, that this is an Isser. And the Yerushalmi and the Maseches Sukkah and elsewhere notes that this is one of three times in the Torah where you find the prohibition to go back to Mitzrayim. The prohibition of returning to Mitzrayim. And you may have heard the claim that, I don't know if this is actually proven, but it's said about the Rambam that the Rambam had a signature when he would sign his letters that he would say that this is the Rambam who violated three lavin every day. So what exactly that means is an interesting question, but apparently it's because since he lived in Mitzrayim, and it sounds like from the Gemara that there are three different Isurim that one could violate by returning to Mitzrayim, so perhaps that's what the Rambam was trying to say, that he violates three Yisurim by living in Mitzrayim. So there's a lot to discuss about that specific Isur, about what exactly that means, and the question of whether or not it applies nowadays, and how did the Rambam justify living in Mitzrayim. In the Mishneh Torah, he brings this Isur of going back to Mitzrayim, and especially if he did sign his letters by saying, the one who violates three Yisurim every day. So even if he doesn't defend himself, so can others defend him? So what else can we say on behalf of the Rambam? So some say, like the Sefer Yireim, that the Isser was only specifically to go back on that path. And the reason the Torah is so clear about the exact route that the Jews took out of Mitzrayim is because that was part of the parameters of the Isser, that you're not allowed to return to Mitzrayim on that path. There are those who suggest that it was specific to that door for a number of reasons. Rabbeinu Bachya says that it was not a mitzvah l'doros, it was only addressing them. And a question about that point?
Your first point.
About the Rambam's point?
No. What's this for to say that, why would it be also specifically that path?
So I think what you'll see from here in general is that there are a number of theories that emerge as to what the Isser is. I think one theory is that either symbolically or actually, you don't want to reverse the gula. So Kadosh Baruch Hu is taking you on a path out. So for you to go back is a message, again, maybe more symbolically than any other way, that you are undoing this process. So especially if you're going to take the same path back, it's a way of really saying that you want to undo the whole gula. So that's one possible way of looking at the Isser. There are others who understand it differently. So the Ramban, for example, says that it has to do with not learning from their actions. That the Mitzrayim, especially at that time, so we know the Mitzrayim were held up as a symbol of immorality in the world. And there are those who argue that today that's not the case. And today, it's not necessarily a fun place to be, Egypt, today. There are many reasons why one wouldn't want to go there.
Antisemitism.
Sorry?
Antisemitism.
Right. There are many reasons why it's not the best place for a Jew to be, but not necessarily in the sense of immorality, that if anything, from a moral perspective, it's a far more conservative society than it was at that time. So it's, again, a dangerous place for Jews, but it's not necessarily the symbol of immorality. And in a more halachic sense, there is a whole discussion, Rishonim addressed this issue, that sounds like from the Rambam that this was not a temporary Isser, this is an Isser that was meant to apply forever. But nonetheless, they also suggest the Prichadish in his commentary to the Rambam, and others suggest that still the Rambam would concede that it doesn't apply anymore today. Why? Because there is a concept that the Gemara invokes in a couple of places, that Asu Sancheirev Bilbul Kolomos, that Sancheirev in his military activities throughout the world, he shuffled the world so much, so national identities no longer apply. So when the Torah has Isurim regarding Mitzri, regarding Moavi, different national identities that impact on Halacha, with the possible exception of Amalek, it's a whole discussion because the Rambam doesn't explicitly say it in the context of Amalek, and there's a whole discussion about how that plays in. But in general, a lot of the Surim that involve national identity, so we have this idea that everything's been shuffled around, and we no longer have that same identity attached to the same people. So the Mitzrim, the people who live in Egypt today, have no real shaykhis to the Mitzrim of the time of Paro. They're an Arab population that is completely different and not descended from the population that enslaved the Jews. So whether or not it's a place you really want to hang out, that's a fair question. But there are those who, among the Rishonim already, who made the discussion that the Isser wouldn't apply to the current population of Egypt. There were those who suggested that if the Mitzrim all got up and went to a different nation, the Isser would apply to that nation. So there's a whole question one could ask, to what extent was it about the land and to what extent is it about the people? It's also important to note that Rishonim, already stay based on the Gemara, the Rishonim basically says this, that the Isser is only if you go there to live, not if you're going there just for business purposes. There is a whole discussion. One of the contemporary Sfarim notes that it's a little hard to believe that there's an Isser to go back, because the Pasuk in Parshas Kisavo on the Tochacha says that one of the threats that we're given is God says, I'll send you back to Mitzrayim. So he's going to force us to violate a law, that's what it means. So different approaches to how you can reconcile that. Some point out that maybe the Isser is only if you go back willingly. So if you're being forced to go back, maybe that's not the Isser. Others point out that maybe the whole thrust of that Klala is that you're not going to have the ability to make a living where you are. So you're going to have to go back to Mitzrayim in order to make a living. And that's not usur, technically speaking. That's what Yerushalmi says. You go there for business purposes. That's not considered to be the isur. So for a moment of synergy here, just to connect this to the sugya that we were discussing yesterday, so the Sefer Achinuch says there's no malchus for this isur because it's a lav shein bo maisa. So why is it a lav shein bo maisa? Because how are you going to violate the isur? So you'll go there for business, and then once you're there, you'll decide do you want to stay there. So the going there was not usur. It's the decision to stay there that would be the isur. And that's the lav shein bo maisa, which would really parallel what could be his understanding. We saw yesterday the Sefer Achinuch says there's no isser for lifnei iver lo sitei mitchel, and we saw that there is the possibility that the way lifnei iver works is that, according to one understanding, is I gave the mitchel to somebody, and that was not yet the isser, and then he violates the aveira a couple hours later. That's when I'm in violation of lifnei iver. So it would have a very similar structure and a very similar reason for calling it a lav shein bo maisa, that you do a maisa at the beginning, but it only becomes clarified as an aveira later on, and at that point you're not doing anything, so we'll call that a lav shein bo maisa. So that's how the Sefer Achinuch understands that there's no malchus for this isser of going to Mitzrayim, because the isser is not for people who simply go there, but for somebody who chooses to live there. So there are some who suggest the contemporary sefer called Leiv Tar says that that's, or maybe it's a different sefer, a different sefer, I'm talking about this, that suggests that maybe that's what's going on here, that the nature of the klal in Kisavo is you're going to have a need to travel around to make a living, but not necessarily that you're going to violate the isser. There are also those who say that the isser is only if you go from Eretz Yisrael to Mitzrayim, which is an extension of that idea about the same path, but that it's only if you're going at least from Eretz Yisrael to Mitzrayim, whatever path, but at least from point A to point B. And that in the time of the Klala, it's referring to they're already going to be in Galus. And the Klala is going to be a Galus on top of Galus. First, you're going to be exiled from Eretz Yisrael. And then when you're ready in Galus, to add insult to injury, you're going to be forced to go back to the same place that you had to be rescued from all those eons before. So again, those types of interpretations seem to emphasize the idea there's more about undoing the galus, that they're more about either symbolically or actually trying to reverse this path. The Sefer Leiv Tar that I mentioned before, so he has this whole thesis essentially that it's really about turning back this process of redemption, both spiritually and practically. So this point, why is the Isser mentioned now, in the middle of really a different point, is because at this point when the Mitzrayim were chasing after them and about to be drowned in the sea, so that was the last break of the Jewish people from the influence of Mitzrayim. And therefore also the idea of Lo Sosifu L'Rosam, that out of the three times, I think this is the only one where it says you shouldn't see them. Why are we talking about seeing them? It's because there's an Isser to see a person who's a Rasha. And here the Mitzrayim have now shaken off any spark of holiness they have left. So Moshe is saying you should not be looking at them at all. And that's its own isser, its own element here, that you have to make a complete break from what was going on. So he suggests that the isser of Lo Sosifu L'Rosam, that's based on Mitzrayim as a personal status, and that Sancheiriv can come and mess up and not going to apply anymore today. But the land has its own concept, and that would apply today. It's a whole itself is a whole discussion. But I think what emerges here is that you have a couple of different attitudes towards what this isser is about, and they could also be hybridized. Then on the one hand, you have this attitude that you don't want to reverse the geula, either symbolically or actually. On the other hand, you have this idea also that Mitzrayim represented a tremendous degree of immorality, and you're supposed to stay away from that and not connect to that, and that may be subject to change in the modern era, perhaps. Or maybe those were all one idea, that all of that immorality was what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was pulling us out of, and anything back in that direction flies in the face of that, again, either as a representation or as an actuality, that we're going back to that source of immorality. There's a lot of halachic discussion about this, about how exactly do you address this question, the practical issue of going to Mitzrayim today, and whether or not it applies. And again, in the modern context, despite and because of the Rambam, you find a lot of heterim. I say despite and because, many defend the Rambam, while at the same time the Rambam, perhaps if this is true that he signed his name that way, maybe didn't sign on to these heterim. But among these heterim, like we mentioned, that if you're there for business purposes, that if you didn't follow the same path, or if you didn't go directly from Eretz Yisrael, some suggest that it's addressed to the whole nation, so it doesn't mean individuals, but it means that if all the Jewish people would go back and resettle in Mitzrayim, so that would be a violation of this system. So there's a lot to discuss about this. There's a lot of halachic literature about what exactly it takes to violate this or any of the three Surim, or are they all the same Isser, in terms of returning to Mitzrayim. There is another discussion about this phrase, Lo so sifu l'rosam odat olam. So there is a dramatic way to address it. It's a story about the Nodeb Yehuda that makes it more dramatic, but the truth is it's in the earlier literature as well, but we'll tell it in the story way first, because it's more interesting that way. But the Nodeb Yehuda was once asked a shaila, that unfortunately there were two brothers who were in a major machlokas with each other, very sadly, and one of them took a shvua that he's not going to ever look at the other one again. Very sad story. So then, ultimately, that other brother died, and the brother who took a shvua that he's not going to see him again, so he felt very bad. And he wanted to go to the funeral, I think was the case. That kind of story worked out. He wanted to go and ask him for mechila. He wanted to confront the dead body of his brother. So the question was, is that a violation of his shvua? He took a shvua, he's not going to see him again. So the Nodeb Yehuda responded that it's a beferish apostolic in Chumash that it's mutter. It's a beferish apostolic that it's not a violation of his shvua. How do you see that? Because here we just said that they're told also see for the rosam odat olam, you're not going to see them anymore. And if you look later on in Revi, we'll have to come back to this in 2 years, tell the story again, but in Pasuk Lamed in this parak, so the Pasuk says, Vayar Yisrael es Mitzrayim esel svasaya, that the Jews saw the Egyptians dead by the ocean, by the sea. So isn't that a direct contradiction? They're told they're not going to see them, and now we're told they did see them. So says the Nodeb Yehuda, no, what's the resolution? Clearly that this doesn't apply after they're dead. You're not going to see them, and you're not going to see them when they're alive, but after they're dead, then that doesn't apply anymore. So that could address the issue, but again, it wasn't just the Nodeb Yehuda who says this. You can find this in the Ibn Ezra, and you can find the quote from the Zohar, and the Torah Tamim comments on this also, that there is a nafkamina here for somebody who takes a shvua not to see somebody again. Can they see them after they die? That you see here that it doesn't apply after a person is no longer alive. Rabbi Svengel talks about this in the Beis Otzar, and he says because of the din of nishtana, the person has changed, so they're not the same anymore. So then any such shvua is no longer going to apply. It's not going to come into effect anymore. There is a difference between when they're alive and when they're dead. Okay, so that's what the story they say about the Nodeb Yehuda, but you can find the whole kernel of that idea in the earlier sources as well. This last pasuk is also very difficult to understand hashgafically. It says, Hashem yilachem lachem v'atem tacharishon. So God will fight on your behalf, and you will be quiet. And you should be quiet, you will be quiet. So it sounds like he's telling them not to call out. It sounds like he's telling them not to daven. And that's a difficult idea to understand, because you would think that it's appropriate for them to daven, but you may also think that it's a mitzvah. That in general, we assume the tefillah that we have today is a chiyuv d'rabbanan. The idea that we daven 3 times a day, and that's the rabbinical institution. The Das Yachid on this matter is the Rambam. The Rambam holds that there is a chiyuv to daven every day, mina Torah. But he would agree also that 3 tefillos a day, in the Surah that we have it, is Rabbanan. But you should daven something every day. The Rambam held this was a din deraisa. And the other Rishonim didn't accept this, including the Ramban. But the Ramban did agree that there is a time when tefillah is daraisa, when it's based tzara. If you're under tremendous pressure, so then that would be appropriate to daven. So the question is, so why is that not the case here? The Mariel Diskin raised this issue. And Mariel Diskin says, l'chora, there's a chiyuv daraisa for them to daven. Why should God say you shouldn't be davening then? So he, and here this also goes to the question of different interpretations of the psukim and the Saliyah. So the Mariel Diskin says that it must be, this is bitmia. So he's saying, how you talking? That God's going to fight on your behalf, and you're not going to daven? Which case would really parallel what Moshe says to the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven when they want to stay behind. So your brother's going to fight on your behalf, and you're going to stay here? So it'll be the same tone in this pasuk, that, oh, God's going to fight on your behalf, and you're not going to daven, you're not going to say anything? How are you talking? It's hard to believe. So that's how the Maharal Diskin understood. But others thought that it was taken literally, like it sounds, that this is not a time for davening. So why that should be is hard to understand. It's interesting. I saw it discussed in two very similar contemporary svarim, that you may be familiar, there's a popular sefer in Chumash called Chavetzelos HaSharim, very lamdish sefer al Torah. So more recently, there's another sefer that came out that has a couple things in common with it. It's a very similar style. The author has the same father-in-law, I think it's his brother-in-law, and he also used a title that was the title of an earlier Baalim, Shailos and Shuvas. There's a Shailos and Shuvas Chavetzelos HaSharim from a century ago. So there's also a Shuvas called Arugas HaBosem. So now there's also a contemporary Sefer HaNechumish called Arugas HaBosem, written by the brother-in-law of the Chavetzelos HaSharim. So both of the Svarim talk about this question. They're both in Parshas B'Shalach, they both raise this question. How are we supposed to understand this idea? If it's a Chiyuv based Tzara to daven, so how should we understand why God is telling them not to daven? So in the Arugas HaBosem, he says that maybe the whole idea of Kriyas Yamsuf and the reason things happened the way it happened there, he says, based on the Rambam, Hilchos Yesodei Torah, is that this was to punish the Mitzrayim. That was why they were essentially lured into the middle of the sea. So therefore, it's not so much that this was really an ace sorrow for the Jews. This was more about punishing the Mitzrayim, and therefore it's not really a time when they had to recognize it as an ace sorrow and daven. I find that a little bit difficult because we have the whole Shira afterwards, and the whole thrust of the Shira is that we do recognize this as a tremendous Yeshua for the Jewish people, and especially because there is the whole literature about whether or not it's appropriate to celebrate the death of the Rishayim, and it is a somewhat nuanced discussion. But our general approach that we don't say Haful Halal on the last days of Pesach, etc., etc., focuses us on the idea that usually we don't celebrate the destruction of the Rishayim, maybe we celebrate the salvation of the Jews. So to focus on Kriyas Yamsuf and say it wasn't about a threat to the Jewish people, it was just about punishing the Mitzrayim, I think it's a little harder to say that that's really the interpretation. So his brother-in-law, Chavetzelos HaSharim, he says it a little bit differently. He has a little bit of a longer discussion about this, where he says that the idea of a tefillah be'ez tzara is only when you really don't know what's going to happen. So you're worried that you may be destroyed, so then you have to daven. But here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is promising them they're going to be redeemed from this, they're going to be saved from this. So essentially, it's not an ez tzara. So I like that a little bit better because it restores it to it being a salvation of the Jewish people. It's just saying that it wasn't something that was particularly a crisis because we knew what the ending was going to be. And then that's maybe what the pasuk is saying, that God is telling you, not that it's bad to daven in general when things are scary, but it was an expression of how much confidence they can have in what's happening now, that God's saying, don't worry, this is one you don't even have to daven for, because my salvation of the Jews is so absolute right now that you don't even have to be davening about it, it's already taken care of. This is already on tap. And then that provokes another question, then, okay, so if that's the case, so then is it appropriate to start saying Shira at that point? Is it appropriate to start thanking God already for what happened if it hasn't happened yet? Is it only appropriate afterwards? Or if you have a guaranteed salvation, you start the Shira then? So he has a little bit of discussion about that in the Chavetz Chaim Sasharon, a similar question. Let's say, is there an avelus for somebody that you know is going to die? A whole discussion. David HaMelech said Shiva for his child who died even before he had actually died. Is there such an idea? So that's a whole parallel discussion that one could have. But in general, this is a discussion to try to figure out what exactly does this idea mean? Why would they be told that they should be silent at this time? It would seem to be appropriate that one should daven. There is another idea, and we'll just mention this, and then we'll end. Meshe Chachma has a comment over here that Medrash Mechilta says. Mechilta comments over here that God is saying Hashem Yilachem Lachem V'Atem Tacharishim, that God will fight on your behalf. He says He'll fight now and in the future as well. But in the future, when they're enemies of the Jewish people, God will fight on your behalf in those times as well. So in the footnotes, in the Meshech Chachma, it quotes from the Mekevus HaMishnah and the Mechilta, that the reason there is such a drasha is because once you have this phrase in the middle, lo so sifu l'rosu modo olam, if we assume that's a mitzvah l'doros, it's a pasuk already being taken out of the current context and referring to the future as well, so then the Medrash says that also that applies here too, that this Hashem Yilachem Lachem is not only about that moment and point in history, but it was about future struggles as well. So working from there, the Meshech Chachma says that that contrast, to talk about the future and not just now, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying like this, saying that, okay, maybe the Jews will have a claim that, in the spirit of how the Aliyah started, that, oh yeah, for sure you have to protect us. You're the one who got us into this mess. You pulled us out of Mitzrayim and exposed us to this risk, so it's only fair that you have to protect us now that we're being chased by the mitzvah. So it's not really such a strong point, again, you know, in the spirit of the whole discussion about the beginning of the Aliyah, but there's a certain logic to it. Okay, you could say, fine, you started saying, you know, it's like the kind of people who will sue a paramedic who's trying to save them. Okay, you know, you got me into this mess, you got to do it right, so to speak. So now you pulled us out of Mitzrayim, you have to save us. So whether or not it's a good taina, but at least it's some kind of a taina. So Kadosh Baruch Hu was saying, not only will I save you today, but even in future generations where you won't have such a claim, where you won't be able to say, credibly or not, that you got us into the situation, even then I will save you. So not only now when you have what to say, but even in the future, v'atem tacharishun, even when you're going to have to be quiet, you're not going to have any argument why it is that I should save you, I will still fight on your behalf even then. That's what the Meshech Chachma suggests, that's what the Pasuk means, v'atem tacharishun, that even without a valid argument why I should be doing something, I'll continue to fight on your behalf. Okay, so a lot to say in a few psukim, a very brief aliyah, but a lot of major themes that come up in these psukim. So we'll close here. I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos.